Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that puts the Ross in Porco Rosso. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen every film in the Ghibli canon.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm watching them all for the very first time.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Studio Ghibli. So Jake, this is a special episode, isn't it, to bring back the series?
Yeah, it certainly is. It's lovely to be back and delving further into these films. We would normally do a film every week and delve into a bit of its history, its context, and my reactions to watching it for the first time. But we thought we'd start with something special. And we've often talked about the special relationships that these films can create.
Exactly. We've spoken before about those special relationships, watching these films with parents, sharing them with children.
With Michaels and their Jakes.
Exactly. And, you know, I have a young son who's approaching 6 months old. I think he's still a little bit young for some of these films, even though he has sat on my lap asleep whilst watching half the films we've covered so far. So what we'll do to address this, we have special guests this week. We have daughter and father. We're thrilled to welcome into the dusty stacks of the Ghibliotech, Honey Ross and her father, Jonathan Ross.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming to talk about these films, guys. I think the easiest place to start and is how I got into this was My Neighbor Totoro. So what was the first Ghibli film that you both saw?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think my first Ghibli film was Spirited Away, in the context that we had gone to Japan and watched it in a screening at Miyazaki's like studio. So very niche. I mean, it's hardly like, oh, you know, just one of those days.
I think you can now drop the mic after that. Yeah, that was your first.
So I'm going to go. I've won this round.
That was because we were out there because I was making a television show for the BBC called Japanorama. And I had been a long time Miyazaki fan, and we were thrilled when we knew he had a new movie coming out, and it turned out to be, I think, one of his greatest, of course, but we didn't know in advance, and he allowed us to see this, and they'd only just put the English subtitles on it. And even though we all have a tiny bit of pidgin Japanese, sukoshi wakaremasu tamamada josu jarimasen, not enough to follow a movie. So
I also don't have any pidgin. I have no Japanese.
You do have a lot, but you were tiny then, of course, and you were too young to read.
I'm also really dyslexic, so I was like, I was too young to read, but also like I just couldn't read for sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear. But so my mum had to whisper the subtitles into my ear. So she was watching the film and then being like...
But it was... that was terribly selfish for me, because I said to her, look, I have to watch this for work, darling, so you're going to have to read it, honey, okay? And I'm going to sit over there and not be disturbed.
But what your brain must have been trying to process at that point as your mum is whispering to you, and there seems to be a man with no face who's just getting bigger and bigger and he's just eating
Yeah, and the kind of, you know, smelly river monster. I mean, like, yeah, it was very overwhelming. But
a
also,
lot of it doesn't really make sense anyway, in a way. You know what I mean? It's like that wonderful, magical fantasy. So in a way, actually, knowing the actual details of what's being said, oh, now they've turned the baby into a sort of rat or whatever it is.
My brain didn't even register what you were just saying. I was like, that doesn't happen. Then I was like, oh, no, it doesn't.
First of all, giant baby, then tiny mouse baby, then bouncing heads. It's like, none of this makes any sense. So you just go along with it, visually. But let me tell you my first one, because it might be quite interesting in terms of just historically, the kind of struggle I think that films, Asian cinema had making headway into the US and UK market is none of them, I believe, had been released over here properly when I first got to know. And this was in the days before DVD as well. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who was a film critic in New York, and he started sending me kung fu movies that I was very into, martial arts movies, and the more interesting ones. I like all the basic ones, but films that were being made out coming out of Hong Kong by directors like Chui Hark, John Woo, these directors at that time, which you couldn't really get over, and they weren't being shown at cinemas, even kind of like niche cinemas weren't showing them. And he sent me, he said, I've just discovered this cartoon. You won't believe it. It's amazing. He said, don't be put off by the title. I said, okay. So he used to send me these VHSs, and I had an American Standard video player so you could play on, which once again was very unusual back then. And we're talking about, this is probably about 86, 87. And he sent me Nausicaa, Valley of the Wind. But he said, it's a film called Nausea, Flight of the Girls. We didn't know what it was called. And I said, okay, this sounds terrible. I didn't know what I was doing. And I saw it. And it's still, that's one of my favourites, because it's such a remarkable, such a surprising movie. I was asked to put on a kind of week of my favourite films at the Barbican a while ago. And one of my selected was Nausicaa, just because I hadn't seen it on the big screen. So to see it on the big screen was amazing. So I discovered it via that, a kind of network of kind of like cineasts and weird fans who knew where you could get this stuff. Once again, you couldn't buy it. I mean, I don't think anyone had a Western release of those things. And so that's when I first got into it. And so I saw that. And then I got hold of Porco Rosso when that came out on Laserdisc. We're talking about that. It's like the house of dead technology here, which still is a movie which kind of like confuses me, frankly, even though I love it. So I kind of fell in love with it. And then I was actually quite relieved when Ghibli and Miyazaki started making like films which made a tiny bit more sense. I mean, still, why is he a pig?
It doesn't matter. He is a pig and he loves adventure and he loves flying.
This
and that's
is
all
the
Porco
Rosso apologist over here.
Yeah.
It's your favourite so
I mean,
far.
It is.
I think it's meant to be because he's so disgusted with mankind that he's turned his back.
Better to be a pig than a fascist, I believe, is the key line in that film. So you were getting into these films maybe a decade before they were being released over here. We've heard stories, it was before my time, where they would be shown at the Barbican ICA,
like
these anime
nights.
Films in the late 80s, early 90s. It must have been tricky to even get a sense of what these films were.
I never saw one on the big screen. Because I was just generally, I mean, I was, and I don't want to make some claim that I was someone who just saw this and fell in love with this. I was always looking for unusual cinema. I was always looking for stuff that couldn't be easily found. So I'd get stuff sent out to me like Urotsuka Doji, the tentacle movie, and that Wandering Kid, I think it was called. So those kind of movies. And in a way, I didn't necessarily know what was a Ghibli film, what wasn't, because once again, they were like second or third generation video copies. But I knew that I wanted to see more of it. So I kind of fell in love with anime rather than Ghibli first. And I was kind of trying to champion that. And I did a show, very early show, before I did Japanorama, I did a show for the BBC just about anime.
Right.
Which I haven't seen for years, where we went out. And I think Porco Rosso was probably the latest of the movies that Ghibli had out when we filmed that. Mm-hmm. So I went out, and we mainly focused on things like Akira and stuff like that, which did get a relatively large reach. And by that time, DVD had happened. Mm-hmm. And there was that manga line that came out and was bringing out a lot of good stuff and dubbing and subtitling a lot of stuff. So even though, like you purists, I'm sure we don't agree with the dubbing.
Yeah, we'd rather not dub.
I've never seen a dubbed one.
We've kept it pure for this one. Yeah.
I'm quite fond of the Spirited Away dub. Like, I kind of love... Haku's a dragon? Oh, but you haven't seen it. Like, I love it so much. It's just like, because it was my childhood.
What is it? A soot baby? It is kind of peculiar. But a friend of ours adapted one, because we're friends with name dropping Terry, but we're very close friends, our whole family, with Neil Gaiman. Mm-hmm. And he was involved in, I think, for Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, he was.
And he said that Miyazaki, he told us... Yeah, he did that.
I had no idea.
Yeah. You've gone off from there. And he said Miyazaki, and this is probably a well-told story, Miyazaki, when it was bought by, I can't remember what company bought it, it might have been Fox or someone in the States bought it, and when they were going to do the subtitle, Miyazaki sent them a present, which was a samurai sword, with a kind of like a veiled threat as to what would come their way if they messed up the dub. But of course, the best way to see it is, you know, in the Japanese region.
It really is, and that's how you saw this, honey, with Spirited Away. Did that kickstart an interest in these films? Of course, you were maybe very small at this point.
Oh my God, I was absolutely transfixed. Yeah. I mean, it started a love affair. Because these were my, you know, obviously I was very lucky growing up in kind of like a good golden age of animation anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I had all the Disney films in the 90s, which were like great. But finding Ghibli was like finding a kind of secret world of film that also like none of my friends knew about it. It was like I was really young, and I remember after that we watched My Neighbor Totoro, and I was like, right, that's it, that's the best thing. And I've got an older sister.
Kiki, you guys loved, didn't you? I loved Kiki's
Delivery Service. Well, because also one thing I loved was there were such interesting dynamic female characters. Like, I think I couldn't verbalize that at the time because I was a child, but I was really glad that I had these kind of really interesting women who were kind of flawed and strange and a bit angsty. And like, I feel like that really helped me growing up. I was like, oh, okay, like it's okay to have a weird relationship with your sister, like in Totoro or like...
What's interesting with that is, and I hadn't realised it until he pointed out, I asked Miyazaki about the kind of beginnings of Spirited Away, which I think, is it Sen to Chihiro in Japanese?
It's about her changing her name.
The reason why the nugget that started the film in his brain was he went to visit family. Mm. I don't know how well known this story is. And one of his kind of nieces or something was about 10 or 9, and he realised there were no films for girls of that age in which they were the kind of main protagonist. And it was kind of lacking. And so he thought, I'm going to go away and create a story for her. really.
Oh, that's
and that's
beautiful.
What's so fascinating, but you realise it's such a kind of gripping thing. And it's so, and you know, it could quite easily have been a boy in that role, I guess. But the fact is, girl, it does kind of land more poignantly on you that she's been wrested away from her friends and her family, and like her whole life is changing, and she's so sad in the back of that car.
It's like that weird, like she's on that cusp right before puberty, where you're kind of like, where do I fit into the world? Like, I'm not a woman yet, but I'm also not a child, and it's that kind of whole. I don't know, you feel very lost. It's a completely liminal space. And I think that is so what the film is about. It's all about, this is a literal liminal space mm-hmm. where the dead are alive and spirits and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know, it's really magical. And I think it captures that feeling of kind of like, I'm 11 and I don't know what's going on.
Well, what's so brilliant as well is because it's all seen from her point of view. So yeah. In a way, and you know, I think this cinema does deserve, and it is to an extent, should be appraised as much with any kind of great cinema. It's like Truffaut's movie, 400 Coups, where it's seen very much, and the camera is even, and Ozu's movies, where mm-hmm. the camera is at the level of people because they're seeing. This, once again, is very clearly and very cleverly all focused from that point of view. But one thing I should say about Spirited Away, which I think Honey will enjoy sharing with you.
About literally.
Okay,
about,
I think we both
are
know
we
exactly
both
what you're going to say.
Bit.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I hate going to restaurants with my parents and seeing Spirited
well,
Away. No, that's not true. I love going to restaurants with you. I think it was when I was younger and I was like a bit like, and especially in the dub, I always vividly remembered when they get turned into pigs at the restaurant. I was like, that's my parents. I was like, oh my God, that's...
So it's become a joke when you go to restaurants
because,
now. But,
because in the dub, it goes, don't worry, baby, daddy's got cash and credit cards. And he's going like...
and
sorry, that's
eating,
like horrible
eating.
Into the mic.
And they said that's what they said
like,
was
oh
me
God.
And my wife, their mother and father, were these two unrestrained, piggish humans.
No question
scoffing.
That would happen
but
to
we
you.
Do now, it's become a family joke. Whenever we go to restaurants, almost without doubt, someone will say, don't worry, honey, dad's got cash and credit cards.
That is wonderful.
I'm going to say that to you when you take me out to lunch, Michael.
I don't like this father figure then you're creating for me here. Now, Jonathan, you've mentioned this visit to Japan where you interview Miyazaki. I think one of the very few British broadcasters who even interviewed him on camera. I remember Japanorama as a sort of teenager into these films at the time. It was so unique that there was someone covering these films on TV.
Well, I mean, the weird thing is, you know, and it's silly having regrets, I always look back and think, I wish I'd done a better job, and I wish I had done a better job, because I think we had a very rare opportunity, which we didn't appreciate, but we were on an incredibly tight schedule. We were doing like 5-6 interviews a day to try and make the show on budget. That day we did less, but we had to film a lot, and we were given permission to film in the Studio Ghibli kind of attraction, which is really weird. And frankly, I'll be honest, we abused that privilege somewhat, because I think it comes directly from Miyazaki that they don't want... Because, you know, there is the tendency, there is the belief that a lot of, in particular, Japanese families, but modern families, see their children's life through the lens of a camera rather than participate in experience. So Miyazaki had banned people from taking photographs and shooting video in there. So it's like, basically, come here and enjoy the experience together, but only have the experience. Don't go home and look at a load of photographs. Don't worry about framing the experience that way. And of course, I thought, isn't that marvellous? But because I had permission, of course I didn't. Of course, I went there and filmed everything. And I was just taking, get back in the cat bus. Kids, get in the cat bus.
Oh, no.
Throw another soot ball. Just
time.
Get, no. Get Totoro out of the way. Just bend down there. I wanted to, it was kind of that. But
it's
we
amazing.
Did have
you can sit inside the cat bus.
Have
and
you been
it's
there?
Full of,
no.
Have you been?
We have.
That's the big dream
God.
That eventually the podcast will take
oh,
us.
Oh, you've
there.
Got to go there. The weird thing is, you
it's
know, you can't buy tickets there. It's so weird, you know, it's so kind of not the Western way. You have to buy tickets at sort of designated ticket kiosk box elsewhere in the city.
Yeah, it's not even nearby.
Yeah, it's not even one nearby. So don't turn up randomly.
But there's like a huge furry cat bus you can get inside. I mean, and also I had just seen the film and sat inside the cat bus and it was full of soot balls and you're just throwing them and you get on top of the bus.
And what's the big robot guy from? Is that from...
Castle in the Sky.
Castle in the Sky, yeah. He's on the roof.
Oh.
And he's about 20, 30
huge.
Feet high on the roof.
Oh,
he's all
it's
covered
just,
in moss. And it's just beautiful.
It's like a childhood dream. It's
and there's
incredible.
A cinema downstairs where they show a short, which at one time, I don't know if it's now been released, but one time you could only see it there.
They never released those shorts
oh, yeah,
outside of the museum. You've
amazing.
Got to go there. And that's something.
And they don't tell you which one's playing because there's three that are on rotation.
We saw one with a whale, I think.
Right. Well, they made a sequel to Totoro, like a short film they only show at the museum.
Wow.
We might have seen that as well. I can't know I'm getting old. I think we might have seen that.
Well, also there's the thing of, this is, I remember my mum took advantage of this. I was like, Mum, our mother, our collective mother, she took advantage of this thing, which was, Miyazaki doesn't let anyone who's an adult into his office.
Oh, yeah.
And so... We were allowed to go. He took us into his office, me, my brother and sister.
I went in.
Yeah. And Mum and Dad were like, it's because of the show, the documentary, we have to come. I'm so sorry. And he was like, okay. And so like we all went.
I think I did the interview in there. And you know, because you know his father was a pilot. I believe. And so he had, it's a very sparse office. I think you can see it on the tape. But he had one beautiful model, you know, and you know the way Japanese people tend to respect craftsmanship very much. And you could see just how exquisitely this was made. There were only two kind of personal effects things I saw in the room. One was this beautiful model of a World War II plane. Beautiful. And the other thing was a beautifully detailed illustration, painting illustration by Goro, his son, the end order that he showed me. And that was it. And everything else there was quite functional. I mean, quite beautiful, but very functional.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense of his personality? Because his films, he comes across as quite a father figure. He wants to inspire these future generations of young people, but he's not a personal filmmaker. Did you get a sense when you spoke to him?
I would disagree with that. I think his philosophy is quite apparent in his films, to be honest with you. And in every aspect of his work and life. I mean, that thing I said about not wanting people to take photographs in the museum, but also I think there's certainly in his films you would see, and I believe this is something that's important to him, a connection to nature, a connection to the natural order things, even going right back. I don't know, have you guys seen Future Boy Conan?
No. Yes, I have, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Future Boy Conan, even in that, which I know he wasn't the prime creator of, but you can see there's a feeling in that. And I think also, I mean, I've read a couple of books. There's one book by him, and then Helen McCarthy's written some very good journalism on him. I mean, she was instrumental in seeing her work in turning me onto all of this. But you get the feeling that there's a kind of just a feeling in his work and sort of developed as an idea in the work, as well as just the way he approaches making it, which is this thing like, you know, do whatever you can to the best of your ability and be in the moment and create something worthwhile, even if it's an experience or a moment. And I think you find that in most of his things, you know, it really is like, you know, just be there. Just be there and do it as well as you can. And I know that his early animation, I've read him talking about this, you know, he said it didn't matter whether he was in charge or not, it didn't matter whether he had necessarily an affinity with the subject matter. He just wanted to do it to the best of his ability at that time. And that's what everyone should do.
Well, it's even the small daily tasks in his films are almost as magical as a bathhouse. It's just this idea of cleaning or cooking.
Well, you look at Ponyo as well. when they're just drinking the soup, and that wonderful, beautiful sequence there, and you think, that really is, that's kind of like, be in this moment and look at the beauty in this moment and experience the moment rather than be thinking about what I'm doing next or treat it as a chore or treat it as a just kind of a necessary physical need.
I always think of the magic of, like, the scene of them cleaning the house in Totoro, and like also them making the food, like the love and beauty of the food and how like inviting and magical it is. It just makes me, like, gives me shivers. It's so special.
We mentioned mostly Miyazaki stuff here, and we have to go through all of these films, so we get into a lot of deep cuts. Michael's number one film is Whisper of the Heart, which is neither Miyazaki or Takahata.
Is that the weird cat guy?
He's in it, but it's mainly the story about the young girl who's writing stories and the cat guy's in that.
I have seen it. I can't remember that clearly.
Oh, it's a terrific movie.
I remember we had like a big weird box set, and I remember watching it when I was like...
Yeah, we had a Japanese language only with no subtitle box set that we bought back, which I've got here in this office somewhere. I've still got it. And it was hard to follow, wasn't it?
Yeah, and also that was when we watched Pompoko.
But isn't it weird that, because Pompoko...
You've mentioned Pompoko now. We've got to address it.
I love Pompoko.
Who does
also
Pompoko?
Such an amazing, amazing message of, like, environmentalism. It's incredible, so ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. But also terrifying. Again, I think we had it in the dub, which was the bit with the, like, I have no face. And it was like, I remember just being, like, haunted. Yeah. Absolutely haunted by that.
Well, that's the sequence that I think we described almost like a 60s or 70s horror manga, where it's these ghosts coming out and their faces, dripping away. But that's a film that, you know, we talk about localization and the differences between the way it's received in the East and the West. That's one where it's in Japan, their testicles.
I find that very interesting.
In the West, their raccoon pouches.
I mean, I've seen a lot of films where if you see them with a kind of an indigenous audience, there's an entirely different reaction in the cinema to what they would get when they're shown to a kind of Western audience. But have you seen, what's that very early series involved in, about the girl who's adopted by a panda or something?
Panda Go Panda.
Do you remember we used to watch that all the time?
Yeah,
Panda Go Panda.
I always had that stuck in my head and I'm like, what's wrong with me?
Well, I should point out that I sang, or I attempted to sing, the theme from Totoro to the Empress of Japan.
Oh my God.
I don't know if you'd care to hear this small anecdote.
Please tell us.
Quite embarrassing. I was invited by the Japanese embassy. I've been there a few times because they know I'm very pro-Japan and I did some charity work after the tsunami a while back. And they invited me along. There was one time when the Emperor and the Empress were coming. I thought, oh, this will be amazing. So I went there, and Jane couldn't make it that day. So I was there alone.
Oh, my God.
And, of course, they're very, 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 very old people.
Oh,
very lovely people. So we're waiting in, and there's a lot of protocol, as you can imagine. So we're waiting in the main hall for them to come in. They finally come in, and you have to stand and wait until they've walked and sat down. But this was a long walk. I'm telling you, that walk took about an hour and a half. We were standing there while the two of the oldest people in the world, very slowly and regally, walked by. Oh, my God. And there were many times I thought, they're not going to make it. They finally got there, and they sat down, and there was an address, and we all said how happy to be there. And then they took a select few to say hello to them, including me. And I went out, and I didn't really know what to say to the Empress. And the translator said, oh, this bar, the Rostan, blah, 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 whatever. He's done this, and he's very... I went, oh, thank you. And then she said, oh, enemy. The woman must have someone. I went, yes, I didn't know what to say. And I went, totoro, totoro.
Oh, my God, what's wrong with you?
Totoro, totoro. And she looked kind of surprised, a little bit disappointed, I'll be honest with you. And then she smiled, and they moved me on. So I never got to explain what I was doing.
That's... I'm actually haunted by that story.
Yeah, yes, and me too. I've never been invited back.
To Japan. Yeah. After that. Oh, crikey.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, honey, you're growing up in a family that where all this kind of cool pop culture stuff is going on, you have the access to go and see a film like Spirited Away. How do you rebel as a teenager there? Do you go off and listen to boring music and watch boring movies? Or
I didn't rebel as a teenager. Like my brother didn't. My sister did. She was a nightmare as a teenager. Whereas I was like kiss ass. Like I was teacher's pet. I was voted biggest teacher's pet in my school, and like. I'm my mum's best friend. So, I just was like, yeah, I just want to watch films with my mum and dad. And, I loved that. I realised that I was very lucky to have access to kind of very special things like Ghibli. I felt very lucky and just lapped it up.
Yeah.
But you had, the thing is, because it was stuff you enjoyed, it wasn't like we ever...
Yeah, you never forced... It was like...
I mean, we did...
It ignited the passion, and then I was just like, this is what I care about.
You were scarred by some experiences in your youth, which were almost like us getting you to watch The X-Files when you were way too young.
Yeah, that was true.
And it was the episode with Tombs, the guys who squeezes into air conditioning, Vince. And
I had to sleep in my brother's bed for 2 months.
And while tidying up this office, I found a note that Honey had written to her mum, in which she said, I promise I will never make Honey watch The X-Files again. And she made her mum sign it. As a kind of binding contract,
because
she
was so still have not watched The X-Files since, and couldn't stand the events for a very long time.
So it wasn't all, we weren't all kind of necessarily showing them the best things.
But I think it was good that I kind of almost had shock treatment when it came to watching things, where it was we're just going to show you everything and you can decide what you like. And it helped me kind of refine my palette and figure out what I like. And also what I like is everything.
Although, we did shield you for some things, because we were saying before we started talking to the guys here, that Jane, Honey's mum and my love, she doesn't like sad films. She doesn't like, so she wouldn't let them watch Edward Scissorhands.
Until I was 13, I wasn't allowed to watch Edward Scissorhands.
And that is why also I made sure you never saw Grave of the Fireflies.
Which I still haven't seen to this day.
And Barefoot Gen I kept from the kids as well, which is an amazing film, of course, a very powerful film, but not one that you would sit down and watch comfortably or easily, or for that kind of entertainment.
Mm-hmm. It fascinates me. I think Martin Scorsese, when he had kids relatively recently, he almost curated an entire lifetime for them of at what points they'll see certain films. They'll start them out on Disney and Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and then they'll work up and they'll have a sort of understanding of film that transcends all boundaries and time. But Jonathan, with horror films, with all these things you're digesting yourself as a film fan and pop culture enthusiast, would you be measuring these out to the kids? Or?
Well, to an extent. I mean, in my office at home, I've got a TV which moves out from the wall, and behind it is a storage space. And in that storage space, it still is right now, I've got multiple copies of all the Ghibli movies, movies, because I would buy 10 at a time. And then when friends had children or came around with children, I would say, and even recently, because a lot of people aren't aware of or exposed to these films, I would say, how old are your kids? Okay, let me go and get a few movies for you. And then I would choose the movies. So obviously Mononoke you only give to older kids. Nausicaa you only give to older kids. Ponyo is the entry point, really, from the features, which is a movie which initially on first viewing, I didn't enjoy it. And I mean, I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it. And now it's one of my favourites, you know.
Yeah, I love Ponyo.
So, once again, it might be because the first chance I got to see that was a dubbed version.
Yeah.
But so I have I have like about five or six copies of each in there. I mean, not Grave of Fireflies, but, you know, all the other ones, you know. And in particular, people who've evolved, and some people are now aware of Spirited Away, for example. Howl's Moving Castle, which is right down on the list for me. It's not a high point. it's not a great film. I mean, the ending, suddenly, okay, I'm going to turn your back. Hey, you don't want to be a broom anymore. Okay, boom.
Yeah, you're like, that was convenient.
I'm so happy to hear this.
We're not but alone. The flame,
vindication.
But the flame character, whatever the spark character's name is, because that was the one, that was all hand animated by Miyazaki, I believe. And that is beautiful.
I think I liked Howl's Moving Castle for the wrong reason, because I was like, he is fit. I was like, zaddy.
He's the dream emo boyfriend.
Yeah, I know. I was like, this is why I like men who treat me like
that's why I like Ponyo as well, because the weird undersea wizard with the drop pearl earring. Yeah.
That wasn't really my sexual awakening.
He was voiced by Liam Neeson, bizarrely, which of course we don't talk about as much anymore.
He was such a Bowie character. He should have been.
It is a beautiful film. Yeah. All the underwater sequences is just superb.
But those films post Spirited Away, which we're getting more release, you know, larger releases over here, that almost perfectly lines up with your phase as the main BBC critic on telly.
Oh yeah, I would always review them.
I remember when I saw Spirited Away at the cinema in Manchester, one of the big quotes on the poster would be from you, and it felt like you were there championing these films. Coming from 20 years previous, where you'd have to seek these films out on Laserdisc or video, how did that change your appreciation of them at all?
Being in that job didn't change my appreciation, but I felt relieved that there was someone, and it didn't have to be me, but I felt relieved, and it was lucky that I felt proud that it wasn't me, but I was relieved there was someone who was open to those kind of movies, because even though I loved watching my predecessor on the film show at the BBC, I often violently disagreed with what he said about films. I remember being a kid, I think I was either 16 or 17, when Eraserhead was released by David Lynch, and he gave it a scathing review. Mm. And I'd gone to see that at the Scala Cinema, which was one of the few kind of rep cinemas in London, back at his old address in Charlotte Street. And I just remember thinking, wow, this is one of the most powerful experiences I've ever had in the cinema. And then to see someone who you respected, who seemed very much an establishing figure, and that's why it made sense, saying this is just meaningless nonsense, which of course is something that Lynch has suffered with throughout his career. I remember when even Mulholland Drive came out, he got a scathing review in the Times. You think, you just didn't understand it. That's the problem. So I was pleased to be in the position where I think I could say, okay, And I think for a while maybe I was a bit hard on some films, not the kind I love, but other ones. And then you develop into being a little more circumspect, and you realise that just because a film doesn't necessarily work for you doesn't mean it's not worth seeing. You know, it could be for someone else. But I did want to champion. I mean, Asian cinema has always been a passion of mine. You know, at the moment, Korean more than Japanese. I'm not that excited by most Japanese cinema, Korean cinema, and some Hong Kong cinema is still exciting to me. But I remember championing In the Mood for Love, for example, the Wong Kar-wai movie, and several people saying to me, I would not have seen that film unless she said. And that was the advantage of having a mainstream platform like the BBC One Film Show to talk about films which might otherwise. And I remember in the very first show we had, it was the Todd Solondz movie, Happiness.
Oh my God.
Which is obviously a difficult watch in some ways, but an incredible movie. Mm-hmm. And I gave it a rave review, and someone phoned me that day and said, yeah, you know what, it's a different show now. And and I was pleased, and it should be a different show, and it should change. It's a shame that show doesn't exist anymore. It's a great shame, but there you go. At least I didn't kill it.
But it did line up with that whole Tartan Asia Extreme era as well.
Hamish.
Exactly. Some incredible films. You know, we recently just had this re-release of Ring. But where do you see? So you say you skew more towards Korean cinema now. What are these?
Well, I'm starting watching Korean TV now.
Right.
Is what's really
on Netflix?
Yeah, on Netflix. But still, you'll see, you know, wonderful films. I mean, I'm not that au fait with the directors as such, but certainly, you know, I do look out for new anime. I mean, I watched. It wasn't very good. I watched a film two nights ago. It was I think it was Takeshi Miike. It was JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, so it was the live-action version of the incredible anime. Mm-hmm. And I love the anime. The anime is so peculiar.
So
yeah, but the film's not great.
He's doing that now. He did a live-action Phoenix Wright film, like the Nintendo DS game.
I mean, I'd like to see that. I object!
Exactly, yeah.
No, it's objection!
Objection! You guys played that all the time, didn't you?
I love Phoenix Wright.
Well, I'm looking for the Animal Crossing game. That's what I want. The Animal Crossing film.
That's just my life.
But I do like, I mean, Stephen Chow, I look out for his Hong Kong movies and some of the action films that come out of those parts of the world. And I saw a Korean movie, I didn't get the director's name, about a kind of a lucky, a man who just had great luck for a day. Right. Did you see that?
No,
I think
no.
It was just called Lucky Man.
Lucky Man. I love Lucky Man.
It was good. It was fun. I watched it, you know. And I'll watch, like, you know, I'll just...
Train to Busan.
Oh, Train to Busan.
It's the best film.
Yeah. Have you seen the prequel?
No, I'm really
Seoul
excited.
Seoul Station is great. It was very hard to find. I don't know if you've seen that, but I found it.
You didn't tell me you found it.
Well, because I didn't want you to watch it, because it's too scary.
Liar.
No, I did tell you I would found it, but you guys, I mean, we love Train to Busan.
Oh, we love Train to Busan.
Seoul Station
apparently they're making a sequel.
I'm looking forward to it.
And an American remake.
But you know what? I don't mind remakes, because if it's good, it's good. And if it's not, you don't have to go and see it. You know, and you've still got the original. It's like, you know.
Or you can just go see it and hate watch it.
And I like the fact that the people who made the original, even if it's just a studio, will benefit financially from that and therefore maybe make more films which are original before they
Well, that's what happened with Ghost in the Shell, the American remake. They went over to Japan and everyone's like, yeah, more money for us.
I mean, I'm just going to now rescind what I said about I don't mind remakes, because Ghost in the Shell, I hate that. I
mean,
love
talk
the
about whitewashing. I mean,
and is that, what's the name of the guy? Is that Mamoru?
Yes, yeah.
Right, okay, because I went to see him.
Yeah.
Somewhere in here, I've got a poster, a Ghost in the Shell poster signed to me from him. I'm not sure where it's gone, but...
You should get ScarJo to sign it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, in Japanese, hopefully. But no, that was an amazing film. Ghost in the Shell 1. Not Ghost in the Shell 2, though. Strangely unsatisfying, you know. But still, his work is pretty incredible. And as an artist, he's brilliant. But to go back to Ghibli, I tell you what I think is very is possibly relevant here is that the fact that clearly Miyazaki wanted to make animated movies, didn't want to make live action films, and he is obviously an artist of the highest caliber. You know, he's a genius, and the fact that he didn't see that as a stepping stone to something else, which I think is more common in the West, is that people think, "Great, I'll direct it," and it's changing now. With films like the Spider-Verse and the Lego movies, it's changing. Yeah. Now it's not seen as the route to get to where you want to go, but it's seen as a destination. Good, I'm a director of animated features. I work on animated features.
I think we've seen that with Wes Anderson.
In the other direction.
From that live action. And he is so known for this idea of like building a totally constructed set that ultimately the destination for him...
Although I don't like any of his animated films.
Oh, no. Really?
Isle of Dogs.
I found Isle of Dogs borderline racist.
Okay.
To be frank, as bad as Lost in Translation, but I didn't enjoy it for that reason. I think that's a very blatant case of cultural appropriation. You want to tell that story, don't say it in Japan. You're not Japanese. You know, don't try and tell it from that point of view and deal with the kind of cultural mores of that grouping there. But I did love, what was the one by the guys who did South Park? The American one.
Oh, Team America.
Team America. It's an amazing film.
Hasn't aged as well as you want it to.
But previously, maybe this young generation are prepared to embrace animation, whether it be stop motion or traditional cell or computer generated, in a way they weren't. Because earlier when we were talking a little bit about Thunderbirds, because I've got a model here in my office, and Jerry Anderson, who I met very briefly a couple of times in life, he always felt incredibly hampered and frustrated by the fact that people would only back his stop motion stuff. His dream was to work in live action. His dream was to do that. And
that's
then he
so
saw that as a way. And it is heartbreaking, especially as he created some of the greatest examples of storytelling in that form. But he was frustrated and hampered. And I think, I like to think if he was doing it now, he'd realise that what he was doing had equal worth and was just as powerful and would last for just as long. And hopefully the new generation are doing that. And so I'm hoping that we will find more voices who see them, their home, their whole career as being an animation, and then we will see them develop as artists in the way we've seen Miyazaki. And we won't see people who do one or two good things, but then move on. You know, and I think that is probably part of the problem.
It's weird, isn't it, that some of those Hollywood filmmakers...
I just watched Bumblebee.
Yeah, Travis Knight, who did Kubo and the Two Strings, and he founded Leica Studios, the stop-motion animation studio.
I love Kubo.
Yeah.
Kubo's beautiful.
But Bumblebee was pretty good.
Bumblebee is good, yeah.
Is that the Transformer movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... fine.
It's better than all the other Transformers movies.
Is that really? Saying much?
Yeah.
I mean, is that not the very example of damning with faint praise?
Could you not call it My Neighbour Transformer?
He's got that. He's a Totoro, like, Paddington-like Transformer.
Yeah, yes. But I mean, wow. Brad Bird's another example, of course, because he went from doing Incredibles and various other things, and now he's doing live action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a shame, because he really seemed to know how to make that form work and how to...
Oh, when The Iron Giant is an all-time
amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. That's one of the few, I think, American animated films that have that emotional wisdom that Ghibli does.
And they tried for a while to make them for a slightly different audience than just a kind of like huge family audience in which everyone from the age of four up would get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what was that? There was, I'm trying to forget the name of it now. Trying to remember that. There was that Treasure Planet thing that Disney did that was pretty abominable. Yeah. But there was
I kind of love Treasure Planet.
There was a cover. I mean, yeah, you did, but then you loved Mulan.
I love Mulan.
Yeah, so...
I think it's a masterpiece. I won't hear anything against it.
But you watched it too many times.
I did, yeah, because it bangs.
You watched it every night for about 2 years.
That was after you showed me X-Files, so that's your fault.
I didn't show you X-Files, blame
me. That was a palate cleanser after X-Files.
Well, we need to take a break now for some family healing. We'll pick up with you guys on the other side.
Well, we did say, to wrap up, so you can go and have your family healing, our not-so-secret aim is to go to Japan. Neither of us have. Many of our friends and colleagues have, and we're very jealous. As people who have been there, what do we need to do? Ghibli-related or not?
Well, Ghibli you need to do, of course. It depends what you like doing. I mean, we love escape rooms, and we also love theme parks, so I would recommend you go to Segopolis, which is the sort of Sega theme park down in Pointaiba.
Amazing.
But it's like an indoor theme park, and they've got a skateboarding thing.
Like indoor ride where you're like, I'm going to die.
You strap your feet
into
a skateboard.
They just strap your feet in.
You go up and you
only
do tricks.
Feet.
That sounds amazing.
You try and do trick moves.
You go up like...
It's kind of terrifying.
You go up like really high, like 15 feet into the air.
Oh, I'd say you go up about 30 feet. I mean, it's a high
wide. And only your legs are strapped in, and you're like having to... And there's a game. It's
on a skateboard.
There's no translation. And people are going like, you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. And I'm like, I don't know.
You stamp when you hit to the top to try and do a stunt move. You stamp on the board. You've got 1 foot tethered and 1 foot sort of free. It's very odd.
It's really stressful. One thing we did when we went to Japan, which I'll never forget, is somehow ended up on, I think it might have been a reality TV show, but it was, do you remember X-Men Dash?
Oh yes, X-Men Dash.
X-Men Dash, we saw this thing, we were like, that looks like amazing. It was like
a
big, like a pop-up assault course. And like, there was like crowds around it. And we were like, oh, go on, we've got to do X-Men Dash. That looks amazing. All did it. None of us have any physical fitness.
Why you say that? and you and Mum particularly didn't rise to the challenge.
Yeah.
And
people like, heckling mum.
Well, Jane Goldman, now one of the most esteemed and sought after screenwriters of all, got stuck at one stage in it, and I think her pants partly fell down. And a lot of Japanese families were delighted to be standing there taking photographs of this. And she was going, I can't get out. And they were laughing, and we were laughing as well, of course, which didn't help matters.
And it was simply because there was a big timer, and everybody's like waiting for you to get out, and a huge queue. And we knew
we
were holding up.
10,
so do X-Men Dash.
And there's a really beautiful, theme park wise, Fuji Q, which is at the foot of Mount Fuji, is wonderful. We all went there, but I was the only one who went through this. We love haunted kind of houses.
We love haunted attractions.
And there's a haunted hospital there, which is the size of an actual hospital they built it. It's over two floors, and it has an exterior ambulance parking bay as well. And you walk through very, very low level flickering light, and you are just kind of accosted by zombies. It takes you 45 minutes to go through the place. It's terrifying.
I refuse to do
it. So that's amazing.
Oh,
what's the one?
Nagashima Spa Land
is a kind of tourist destination. Mainly only Japanese families go to. I think we were the only Westerners in there.
People were just staring at us, amazed we were there.
And it's got a theme
it's
park
like
next to a kind of giant onsen hotel. And they have a big market in the reception area on like Friday and Saturday night, selling like fish and goods. It's really amazing.
That's really cool.
And what is it? Hanayashiki.
Hanayashiki
is, I believe, the oldest theme park in Tokyo. And it's a tiny, quaint little one with some really fun rides in. And that's well worth going to.
I love you really get a sense of like our mental state. We only go to theme parks.
We don't go to temples. We go to restaurants and theme parks. And there's also if you like room escapes, you know, escape room type.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a few in Japan, but there's one which was amazing. This is the trip you didn't come to that room.
No.
And of course, it's not in English. It's only Japanese. But you can do it without that. And you're basically they've got a whole. I think it's a three floor house, inhabited by a ghost. And there is an actual ghost, and you have to try and escape from the room. And like every 10 minutes or so, there's a bell sounds, and you have to find a spot with a prayer to hide, or else you will be discovered by the ghost and taken away.
And Harvey threw Mum under the bus.
We did not throw Mum.
Hid in like really good cupboards, so she had to hide under the table.
It's like musical chairs. You're near a chair. You're going to sit on it. We were near a prayer. We grabbed that prayer. She couldn't find a prayer. And the ghost took her. Fine.
Well, yeah, you can't find a prayer.
Tough. That's life in the haunted house. But that was great fun as well. But I mean, essentially, and there are a number of people you can speak to who actually do sort of like help you bespoke tours. But I think if you just sniff around and find out what
I think the best thing to do is like go to like a proper onsen or like
that themed onsen
or like a Ryokan. Do a Ryokan. Yeah, that's the best experience.
And also, if you get the chance, try not to just do Tokyo because I'm trying to think of the city we went to. Kyoto.
Kyoto
is one of the most beautiful cities on Earth. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous.
And also go in autumn when the trees are like...
That's what we're thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you've got to go. You've got to do it.
Well, locals call it leaf peeping. It's called... It's called... It's like, I'm trying to remember the Japanese... It's something like Hanagaru or something like that. And it means leaf peeping, which means you do a tourist visit to just go and watch the leaves changing colour.
We peep
but
those
it does
leaves.
Mean it does mean it's harder to get hotels because leaf peeping is a major attraction. So at prime leaf peeping time, in leaf peeping season, you might have trouble getting into a hotel.
Okay, maybe let the leaves fall off early. A bit just to get a bit more budget flight.
Catch the tail end of the peeping.
Yeah. You'll have a great time. It's a wonderful country, amazing people, and also the food is such thing as a bad meal.
We all came back like two sizes bigger, and I have no regrets about that.
Nor me.
Oh, wow, I can't wait for this trip already. You're the first people we've asked for recommendations. Thank you so much.
Try and eat some blowfish while you're there as well. It's kind of illegal in some places, but I had a blowfish feast. I'll say that again. I had a blowfish feast. It's called fuhu, I think, which is, you know, it's got toxicity in the animal, which makes your lips go numb. So you have to have a chef know what you're doing or you can die. It's in the Japanese constitution that the emperor's not allowed to eat fuhu. Although he does secretly sneak out to this restaurant, I believe.
I rewatched that Simpsons episode so much on a tape. Yeah.
Well, it was something like a 12-course meal, and every course but one had blowfish in. So it was like blowfish risotto, blowfish bones in soup, blowfish meat, blowfish sushi. And at the very end, I thought, well, I've survived the meal. And he said, dessert, special dessert. And I think, thank for that. I've worked for this. You know what the dessert was?
Blowfish ice cream.
No, a strawberry. One strawberry. I mean, it was quite a large strawberry, but don't build it up and then just bring out a strawberry. I mean, after the amount of skill he'd shown in filleting a blowfish, you'd have thought he'd have had some skill in the pastry department, but no, just a strawberry on a plate.
So just before we sign off, if you're going to recommend one Ghibli film to our listeners, maybe they've already seen them, but what would you recommend a beginner to listen to watch?
A beginner? If it's your first, I would say Spirited Away or My Neighbor Totoro, because I think you can't go wrong with either of those.
I mean, my favourites, the thing is, it depends, because I always recommend based on age, based on what films I think they want. You know, so young kids, you'd give Ponyo first, I guess, or Totoro. Mm-hmm. They're the two entry level for younger kids. Spirited Away, I think, is probably the masterpiece, although many of them, but I do think it's in my top 10 list of greatest films ever made. And we watch it often. I remember when you were ill, once you came out of the house, and I said, shall we watch Spirited Away?
Yeah.
And we just snuggled on the bed and watched Spirited Away.
It's
a real boost whenever it's on, I find myself watching it, because I just adore it. But I also love even stuff like Castle of Cagliostro.
Yeah.
I love that. And the Steven Spielberg once said that he thinks that film contains the greatest car chase in cinema.
Yeah.
Which it is pretty amazing. That's a Lupin film, isn't it?
It's a Lupin film. There's an interesting bit of trivia there. The video game based on that film is in the Goonies.
Oh.
The arcade cabinet is in the background of one scene.
I didn't know that.
So that's almost the Spielberg connection there.
So I love that film, but I really love Castle in the Sky.
I love Castle in the Sky.
And that's underrated. And I love Nausicaa. And Nausicaa, I think, is the most massively underrated of all of the Ghibli films, and very rarely seen. But it's such a complex, such a sophisticated, such an adult story told for younger people. And the animation is exquisite. I have somewhere I've got the manga of that as well, which I think Miyazaki himself illustrated it.
Yeah, for
just
years.
Beautiful.
Volumes and volumes of the
beautiful,
stuff.
Beautiful, beautiful work.
See, this is very exciting because we think, because we're 13 films in now, we've done many of the big hitters, especially their more recent films, Howl's and Ponyo and so on. We've got Castle in the Sky and
so
Nausicaa to come. So,
Jake. Castle in the Sky is amazing. Yeah. And Lapusha is amazing as well, of course.
It's a lot of
that early stuff we haven't got to yet.
But Future Boy Conan, I'm really fond of.
Yeah.
Future Boy Conan's, and it's very, I've got it on, I think it's called VCD.
Yeah.
I had to find it on. I couldn't find it on DVD or anything.
For beginners, you're recommending watch the entire catalogue.
For beginners, watch X-Files. And if you're not a chicken, if you're not a baby, then maybe you can watch something else.
Well, you have to pay for the therapy bill, so not my problem.
Baby.
There it is, folks. The recommendation from the Ghibliotech is The X-Files.
Particularly the Tombs episode.
Yes.
Yeah. Great, great family drama.
Oh, well, Honey and Jonathan, thank you so much for all those recommendations and anecdotes and stories for us today. So if you want to find more of your stuff online, where can people find you if they need to find you?
I mean, I'm hard to avoid, so that. But Honey's just about to start a podcast with a friend, aren't you?
Oh. Yeah, you can find me at Honey Kinney on Instagram or at Pink Protest, which is an activist collective I am a co-founder of, and we are starting a podcast called The Body Protest.
Brilliant.
Which is about body image.
Yeah.
And it's with me and a body image researcher called Nadia Craddock, who is much smarter than me.
And, I mean, we'd like to plug the short film you produced as well.
Yeah.
Because
we're big
do.
Fans of Right Place, Wrong Tim.
Thank you very much.
Which you can find on Vimeo.
Yes, on the Channel 4 Random Acts YouTube, Vimeo. Make sure you go and check that one out. It is quite a fantastic film.
It's a bloodbath.
Honey's making a new one, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. We are working on our next one, so very exciting.
And Jonathan, you're tweeting at Wossy as always.
I'm at Wossy. I'm on Instagram as well. Am I?
You're me Wossy.
I'm me Wossy, but it's mainly pictures that only old men of my age would like to see. And if you like see the office we're in now, which is an amazing place, I just put some pictures of my new 8-track player. Most young people don't even know what an 8-track is, of course.
I've seen one or two.
Vaguely an idea, yeah. So I like old vinyl, I like old record players, I like old television sets, I like building model kits.
I like your Instagram so much, sometimes I call it Deliciously Wossy, because he posts photos of his smoothies.
Well, I realise I haven't posted for a while, I better post. I think, what's nearby? Ah, my plate. And that's it. I don't put a lot of work into curating it.
He's no Kylie Jenner.
Ah, well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jake, you and I will be back shortly with a full series of single film episodes. But until then, you can follow Jake on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham.
And you can follow Michael at Michael J. Leader.
Gibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng. Our artwork is by Sophie Moe. And Lister Russell makes us sound good. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts. That's me.
Okay, so just to say farewell, I dug out of my office here some of the things that Honey and I brought back from the Ghibli shop outside the museum. Mm-hmm. So we've got in front of us here, we've got Castle in the Sky, we've got Kiki's Delivery Service, or Home Delivery Service, is it? I'm not sure what the full translation is. We've got Lapusha there as well. And we've got, of course, everyone's favourite. I'm going to play this one for you. I'm going to wind this up. And it's a little blue Totoro and the little white Totoro being chased by May. Hey. And here we go. Have a listen to this. One time.